The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the obesity epidemic has grown in size over the years, so has the business of weight loss. A nearly $60 billion industry devoted to the promise that losing weight improves quality of life, health, and self-esteem. While it may be better for your health, some recent research shows that shedding pounds won't necessarily make you happier. Ed Cara is a science writer and contributor to Pacific Standard and to The Atlantic, where he recently wrote about the correlations between weight loss and mood. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks so much for having me.
So you did write that there have been some conflicting reports on how weight loss affects mood over the years. So first of all, what are some of the historical findings that provide context for how we even look at this issue today?
Sure. Well, the problem is like people really haven't been looking at it too much. The drive has been to lose weight at no matter what the cost. You know, with the rising obesity crisis, you know, it's been basically lose weight. That's been the message that we've been getting from everywhere, including the health world. But when you look back in the 50s, the ways they made people lose weight through starvation, like very severe starvation diets, it often drove people to the brink of their sanity almost. There were reports of psychosis and just severe mental problems from a lot of the early weight loss trials that they used to do back in the 50s. But as time has gone along and people have been a little bit more cognizant of those risks, the clinical research, when you try to make people lose weight in a controlled environment, generally people's moods do seem to improve, especially if they're heavier when they first start. And then when they lose weight, their mental well-being is generally high. But as I detailed in the study, in the article, when you look at people losing weight in the real life, in the real world, the conclusions are basically the opposite.
Well, let's fast forward to the primary study that you were looking at and you wrote about in this article. This is where a team of researchers looked at the English Longitudinal Study of Aging. This is a huge database that tracks a number of people over 50. Now, what did they find?
So what they did is they basically, you know, this sort of research is used for all sorts of different types of studies. And it basically just tracks people, their health status, generally people above the age of 50, and basically just looks in on them, you know, every year as they report how they're feeling or, you know, how they're physically and mentally doing. So what they did is they basically isolate the people without any depression or any coexisting mental illness, just to make sure that's healthy. They looked at people that were obese and overweight, and they keyed in on the people who had lost weight in between the 5 years, or I think it was 4 years, that they looked in on them to see if those who had lost weight had reported any improvements in mental well-being. And what they found is the people that had lost weight were significantly worse than the other groups, the people that either had stayed at the same weight or gained weight even.
Well, if people expect pain while they're losing weight, right? The no pain, no gain. You know, we watch this on programs like The Biggest Loser. There's a lot of drama. There's a lot of drive and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But ultimately, you're supposed to be happier after you've lost the weight. That's not happening?
For some people, I'm sure that does happen. You know, I detail a little bit of mine. You know, when I lost weight, I certainly felt happier about myself and happier about my station in life. And when you look at the clinical research, it also shows that. But what makes people happy when they lose weight is not the weight loss itself, but what they're doing with their lives. You know, maybe they're trying a new diet, or they're running more. And those things do make us happier. Exercise can make us happier. It just might not necessarily make us lose that much weight. So focusing on weight as the sort of the proxy or the measurement of happiness is a flawed idea, I think.
Well, you lost many pounds. You went from 226 to 160?
Yeah.
Congratulations, first of all. But, you know, that's significant. Is there any difference in the amount of weight people lose and their well-being at the end?
Well, one of the studies that I looked at, or I detailed, was basically just a giant review of all the clinical research on people losing weight. And what they found was that diet and exercise together, that turned out to be the most successful in terms of weight loss. But the amount, no matter what technique you use to lose weight, it didn't correlate with the happiness, basically, how happy they were before and afterwards. What really determined it was basically how they felt about their lifestyle changes. You know, the support they got from the medical professionals that were in the study. Basically, the more they cared about their lives and how they were living it, that's what determined how happy they were, not necessarily what they were doing to lose that weight.
You're making me think of studies that I've heard or read about on the amount of money someone makes. You know, it's sort of like after a certain amount, money does not make them happier. Do you think it's sort of like that? No matter how much weight you lose, you're not happier.
Well, sure. Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. It's just that no matter what change you make in your life, there's always sort of a plateau, you know, a new job, new money, new girlfriend, you know. Eventually, our happiness levels always kind of go back to where they were, the base level.
So why do you think weight loss may not have this kind of emotional surge that society and very many people in the weight loss industry argue that it will?
Because I think, I mean, from at least from my experience, you know, the amount of work mentally, physically, and emotionally that I had to do to lose the amount of weight I did, it took me to the brink in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I hurt myself. I hurt my relationships with people. It just takes so much out of you to struggle against the biological imperative to keep that weight. And I think it just wears people out. You know, and when we get these smiling advertisements of people when they're on their weight loss or, you know, in a Weight Watchers commercials, people that are so happy, and you don't see the amount of work that needs to go into that to even accomplish that, even temporarily. And then it's a rigged game. People you see win the lottery. You don't see all the other people that, you know, spent $100 and didn't win anything. You know, you just see the happy winners, the rare, lucky few people that do get to lose weight.
A fitness website did write a response to your article for The Atlantic, and this urged readers to distinguish between clinical trials and, quote, population studies, like the one that you wrote about, the longitudinal study. Do you see any drawbacks to the way that this research was conducted or its results?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Every type of study has its drawbacks. You know, for this study, it can't tell you the exact cause, you know, and they tried to account for it, but there might have been an illness that made someone lose weight and be depressed about their lives. You know, illness does make us sad. Maybe someone had died in their lives, and that made them lose their appetite and made them more depressed. So there's definitely drawbacks to that. But again, there's drawbacks to the clinical stuff too, because people, when they lose weight, they're not losing weight normally with a team of doctors around them, you know, helping them, basically, you know, aiding them, checking in on them, making them feel better. Even having a doctor like ask us questions or you know, give us an examination, there's a little bit of a placebo effect to that. You know, that in of itself makes us more likely to watch out, to look for our weight, to watch out for our health, to be more healthy than someone that's, you know, just trying to try a new fad diet. So I think the population studies are much more the real life version of how people try to lose weight than what you can get in a laboratory.
Well, even if people don't come sort of bouncing and smiling out like, Jennifer Hudson on the Weight Watchers commercials, right. isn't losing weight still something that overweight people should be trying to do? I mean, it is a little like putting away something for retirement. It may not be a happy experience, but better in the long run.
And I think, and you know, this has sort of been happening a lot in the public health world. I think the focus is starting to shift from losing weight to doing healthy things, to having healthy behaviors. You know, and the way I've always thought of it is that if you get on a good diet and you go running 3 times a week and, you know, you start all these changes that will improve your life, you probably won't lose 20, 15 pounds. You might lose 10, you might lose 5, but you'll be immeasurably happier and you will be healthier. You know, people, and I detail some in the article, an overweight person who is fit tends to live just as long as a thin person who is fit. So the fitness level, more than the sedentary behavior, you know, how much we stand and how much we sit, those probably have a lot more to do with our life expectancy and our life happiness than the amount of weights we have. So I think a focus from the pounds to just healthy behaviors, healthy fun behaviors.
Well, Ed Cara, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Virginia.
Ed Cara, he's a science writer and reporter for Medical Daily and a contributor to The Atlantic. And that's where you can find his recent article, which the title pretty much sums up, weight loss doesn't always lead to happiness. Regardless of how it makes you feel, this is not the ideal season for trying to lose weight. The holidays are punctuated by gluttonous parties, lavish meals, cocktails, cookies, and my favorite, eggnog. Much as we love these holiday feasts, next year it may be in the country's best interest to swap out our standard holiday fare for alternative foods like asparagus, artichokes, and pomegranates. Why? Because these arid desert crops require little water to grow. And with a changing climate and an ongoing drought on the West Coast, using less water may no longer be a matter of choice. Christopher Cook writes about food and the food industry, and his recent article about drought-friendly desert crops was published in Craftsmanship magazine. Christopher, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Our water footprint is not something we're often thinking about when we're at the grocery store. Please remind our listeners of how water factors into what we eat.
Yeah, I mean, water is central to our entire food supply, but it depends on what we grow and how we grow it. And so there are crops and foods that are incredibly water intensive and water wasteful, and that we can no longer really afford to eat so much of and grow so much of. And then there is a whole beautiful array of crops, tasty foods that have a long history in agriculture and in our diets, that are far more efficient in terms of water use and have a long record of growing in deserts and in arid climates.
What are some of those drought-friendly crops?
Yeah, so some of these we're more familiar with, like amaranth, quinoa, pomegranates, tepary beans, arugula salads, heirloom Native American crops, such as certain varieties of corn and squash and beans, Sonoran wheat, different varieties of zucchini and spinach, even certain varieties of almonds, which have gotten a lot of bad press, as a water waster. So there are a lot of different, very tasty, highly nutritious foods that grow very well in arid climates, which is increasingly what so many parts of the world and the U.S. are facing in the era of climate change and chronic drought.
You did mention an alternative type of almonds. It is one of those crops that gets a lot of attention for the staggering amount of water required to grow them. But tell us a little bit about some of those other thirsty crops and how much it actually requires to grow them.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, the almond takes a gallon per nut, famously, 3.5 gallons of water per tomato, 6.5 gallons for a potato, 18 gallons for an apple. The biggest, however, is beef and other livestock, and 2,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. So it's quite a dramatic scale of difference when we get into meat consumption, and particularly beef, because it takes so much water both to feed and sustain the livestock, but also to grow the crops that we feed them, such as alfalfa.
Well, there's a reason why so many people are farming or raising beef, because of the market. So tell us more about those forces that determine which crops farmers are growing. If California's farmers are facing a drought, wouldn't it be in their best interest to grow tepary beans or mesquite carob, one of these drought-friendly crops?
It would be nice if it were in their direct economic interest. And it could be if the market and certain incentives were switched. Right now, so much of the market is defined by a current demand, not just domestic, but global and export-driven demand for things such as exporting almonds to China, for instance. The beef industry and dairy industry are huge economic breadwinners for the state of California and for other states. You know, the top crops in California, in terms of revenue, of value, are highly water-intensive. When we look at rice, even still cotton being a prominent crop, even though it's diminished a bit, beef and dairy, strawberries, lettuce, almonds. Meanwhile, there are all these other foods that used to be grown in much greater supply, certain varieties of wheat, bean varieties, and the production of some of those has declined. And the reason is because of market signals. Now, unfortunately, what we need to do is change the market signals by you know, encouraging markets to, and consumers really, to look at some of these alternative, so-called alternative crops, which are actually long-term, you know, traditional heritage foods, and also to provide incentives for farmers and signals for farmers to produce these foods, which are far more climate-friendly, drought-friendly, and again, they're delicious and nutritious, which doesn't hurt.
Christopher Cook, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Christopher Cook, he's author of Diet for a Dead Planet. And you'll find a link to read his article for Craftsmanship magazine about drought-friendly crops. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Cooking and presenting food is a daily part of life, but it is also an art and a science. In this story, Ari Daniel of Small Matters takes us to a small restaurant that takes the artistic and scientific aspects of food very seriously.
Just outside of Atlanta, there's a special place called the Kimball House.
Our first goal as chefs is to nourish people.
Jeffrey Wall is the co-executive chef at the restaurant. The other chef is his friend, Philip Meeker.
And it's about presenting something new, a new experience.
That new experience involves the freshest and most local of ingredients, the use of modernist techniques, more on that in a moment, and partnering up with this guy, Justin Gallivan.
I am a card-carrying chemist at Emory University. This is like an arranged marriage that seems to have worked very well. So.
Gallivan's also a pretty good amateur chef, and he's gotten into using things from his chemistry lab in the kitchen, which just thrills the two chefs at Kimball House. For instance, when Gallivan entered the restaurant kitchen that evening, he came bearing gifts. He'd taken ground-up toasted pecans and run them through his centrifuge.
This was spun at about 10,000 times the force of gravity, and what that does is it basically moves the heavy stuff to the bottom.
And the lighter stuff moves to the top.
So you start getting a separation, and on the top, you can actually see this nut cream.
Oh my God, this is insane.
A middle layer is pure pecan oil.
It smells like a pecan pie. Take a sniff of that.
Oh my God.
The chefs instantly assimilate the new taste into their flavor repertoire and incorporate it into the salad course. I should say that the term salad is used rather loosely around here.
Think Monet, you know, the beautiful lily-like paintings.
Philip Meeker wants to make the salad look like a pond. Juiced vegetables,
romaine, celery, fennel,
form the green pond water. Nasturtium leaves have become mini lily pads, and it's finished off with a couple drops of Gallivan's pecan oil. The result really does look like a pond on my plate. Gallivan is grinning.
Well, I just got a bit of the pecan oil, and it's just fantastic. It's just bursting with pecan flavor.
Chef Jeffrey Wall is just as pleased.
To be able to execute clean flavors like this that are so concentrated is what everybody wants in the culinary world.
What does chemistry have to do with cooking?
I think everything. Cooking is a constant battle with learning how food works, and food is chemistry.
Case in point, the final dish in our 7-course meal.
This is the duck that we fed figs and almonds to make them nice and flavorful and fat. Feeding ducks figs is a 4,000-year-old technique.
Meeker and Wall worked up the duck in 4 different ways. First, a roulade made by rolling up the breast inside the skin and searing it to caramelize the exterior. Chemist Justin Gallivan.
Caramelization is basically heating sugars to very, very high temperatures. There's also browning reactions that are collectively known as the Maillard reaction that are also associated with producing flavors and some of the colors.
The second preparation is a duck mousse made from pureeing the legs and tenderloins with creme fraiche and a touch of nutmeg.
We're just transforming matter from one state into another, and whether it's transforming molecules from A to B or transforming this duck to some remarkable dish, it's all chemistry.
Third, a homemade ravioli made from ricotta, bok choy, and duck leg confit. That confit was cooked using a modernist technique called sous vide.
So sous vide is a process in which food is cooked in a water bath to a very precise temperature. And you let it sit, and it will equilibrate. And it cannot overcook.
And the final preparation.
The pastrami that we made, and then put it on some toast with some fig jam and almonds. Full circle, you know, we wanted it to eat figs and almonds, and then we wanted to serve it with figs and almonds, and we had high-tech equipment to cook all this at perfect temperatures, and then yet it's a 4,000-year-old technique, so enjoy.
The preparations of duck are displayed on a long dish, each one a swirl of form, color, and aroma. What's happening in this kitchen is a deep blend of science and art. Chef Philip Meeker.
We try to take many different viewpoints. We think about maybe a song, and we think about this flavor's parallels to notes, or we'll think about a nice poem by Ezra Pound. It's always good to find inspiration everywhere and to have your mind open.
In finding inspiration in music, poetry, and chemistry, the result at Kimball House is unforgettable. Literally, this is probably the best meal of my life.
Thank you, everyone. Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jesters do oft prove prophets, wrote William Shakespeare in King Lear, and prophets sometimes turn out to be jesters. Take Elijah from the Hebrew scriptures taunting the pagan god Baal for taking a lengthy toilet break, or Martin Luther mocking the dubious relics flaunted by the Catholic Church, or Monty Python ribbing the Vatican's ban on birth control.
Every sperm is sacred.
The religious satirist scoffs and stings with a purpose, targeting greed or corruption or hypocrisy, tearing down in order to build up. In his new book, God Mocks, author, filmmaker, and professor Terry Lindvall chronicles the evolution of religious satire from the Old Testament to Stephen Colbert and The Onion. Terry Lindvall, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It's great to be here.
Well, you looked at religious satire back through the Hebrew prophets and Rome and the Reformation up until today. So the targets and the language and the methods change through time. Anything that they share?
They do share two things. One, they have a sense of moral or political or religious reform. They want to change things. They believe that things are not as they should be. But the second thing is they have a wit. They have a sense of humor about that. And they recognize that in this incongruity of the way things are and what they should be, there is kind of a comic incongruity as well. Søren Kierkegaard, the great 19th century Dane, said, there's something not right with this world. And so he began to attack the church as being frozen and being dead. And he became kind of a model of the ironic satirist, much like a Stephen Colbert today.
You actually plot a quad of satire, which I think is quite funny in itself.
It is.
Along the
it
vertical is. Axis, we have humor and rage and where people fall in between that, or ridicule and moral purpose on the other axis. So there is a range, but what's effective? Give us some examples.
That's a really good question, because I think those that use humor more than rage are more effective. John Skelton in the 16th century introduced a whole approach called flighting, which is really like the dozens today, your mama, in which you kind of really mock angrily those people against you. And we have certain comics on late night television who have this kind of anger to them, very acerbic wit. But when you have more of a gentle wit, you're coming at people and you're laughing at yourself and you're getting them to laugh, I think you can find yourself moving them better.
So where would Chaucer fall on that quad of satire?
Chaucer would fall wonderfully in both kind of a subtle moral message that comes to him through him, but also a lot of humor. Much like one of my favorites is Robbie Burns, who really brings a wee bit of devilish satire into what he is
doing.
This
is the Scottish poet, Robert Burns.
Robert Burns, and just funny. I mean, he was so honest about his wrestling with the flesh of the devil and everything else. In fact, he saw the devil much like C.S. Lewis did, as kind of a screw tape character, very comic. But he would say, oh, that some power would give us the gift to see ourselves as others see us. Mm-hmm. Because when we have that mirror, we are more apt to change from the inside.
Terry, we played a little bit in the lead from The Life of Brian. This is the Monty Python film that was derided as sacrilegious by many. So what is the difference between sacrilege and satire?
I think sacrilegious does not try to reform. It does not have a love for its object. in the sense that you are just making fun of, mocking, ridiculing, there's no affection. The true satirist has a love for the object. He or she wants to see that change from the better to the worse. It's like a parent with a child. There are gentle teasing ways to get the child to recognize what he or she is doing and bring them along. Or there are ways just to kind of alienate. And I think many of our contemporary comedians alienate. They do not try to engage in a way. Now, I think Stephen Colbert is an exception. He and C.S. Lewis were very similar. They both lost parents early in their life. They both had a crisis of faith and became atheists. They both, again, then stumbled into the faith and started reading the scriptures and reading people that were Christians, and then began to make that really part of the fabric of who they were. And I think both of them found in that kind of a freedom to look at themselves and kind of mock themselves in their own spiritual journeys.
Here's a little clip from Stephen Colbert. This is when from the Colbert Report, his previous show. Here he's playing as if he's hungover from going on a Catholic bender, as he put it. Now, he'd given up Catholicism for Lent, but he was lured back in.
I thought I could make it all the way to Easter, but on Friday night, I was walking by St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I caught a little whiff of incense, you know, and that's my trigger. And I just thought, hey, I'll go in. I'll kneel down for a minute. I thought I could handle it. Well, long story short, I went on a Catholic bender, and I didn't remember a lot of the weekend. I got, oh my God. I got,
Stephen Colbert there. Terry Linval, how is he different from Bill Maher or Richard Dawkins or one of those others that sort of makes fun of the rituals of the church?
I think he is different in the sense that he has a love for the things that are ultimately sacred. And he can look at the sacraments, he can look at the crucifixion and resurrection, and he sees something true there, and he sees something worth celebrating. And yet he looks at the abuses of the church, which some of the others look at too, and he can be as vitriolic as they are about the things that are wrong. When he spoke to the Capitol and he recognized the way that we as a country were treating migrants, he was able to quote Jesus as, in so much as you don't do this to the least of these, you don't do it to me, and was able to kind of use scripture in a way that if they identified with it, they could respond and say, yes, you're right.
Now, we all know there is a long tradition of great nations importing foreign workers to do their farm work. After all, it was the ancient Israelites who built the first food pyramids. But this is America. I don't want a tomato picked by a Mexican. I want it picked by an American, then sliced by a Guatemalan and served by a Venezuelan in a spa where a Chilean gives me a Brazilian. Because my great-grandfather did not travel across 4,000 miles of the Atlantic Ocean to see this country overrun by immigrants. He did it because he killed a man back in Ireland.
As long as there have been religious beliefs, there have been satirized to mock and jibe and prod the corruption and hypocrisy of the devout. Terry Linval is with us to talk about how sacred satire has evolved from the Hebrew prophets to the Onion. Well, and some people get the joke. Other people often don't. You mentioned the Onion in the book and, you know, some headlines. Christian charity raising money for non-gay famine victims. Creationist Museum acquires 5,000-year-old T-Rex skeleton. And one that a lot of people believed was real. The Planned Parenthood opens new $8 billion abortionplex. Is that a sign of good satire that people think it's real? Or that it's bad satire?
I think it shows how illiterate our audience is. I mean, I think satire is dangerous today because people are generally ignorant. They have no sense of tradition. They have no sense of irony. Irony is very difficult to read. And if you can't read irony, you're just going to get angry. I mean, my favorite Onion headline was essentially, Christ categorically denies speaking to a Lutheran college administrator or a televangelist.
You're looking at satirists as tearing down to build up, as if it were a cancer that must be cut out to heal. Now, I'm looking over this history and seeing a lot of cuts, but not a lot of healing. Do satirists ever truly reform?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think there are a couple people in particular Timothy Dwight in the 1800s was the president of Yale. He began to attack the people who thought that all religions should merge into one, just celebrating man. And the people who said that hell is no more, like Ingersoll later on. And he says this just allows rogues who persecute widows and exploit the poor not worry. He says what we have to do is come back and do good. Even following that is the Anglican or the Catholic Ronald Knox in the 20th century, who mocked the modern church first. He cut it down in a little article called Reunion All Around. He said all the kind of Episcopal Anglicans accepted everyone as members, the Buddhists, the Muslims, the atheists, because they just wanted kind of unity and good fellowship. But what broke the unity, as he pointed out, was diet. For the Muslims held it was sinful and unclean to eat the flesh of a pig or drink fermented liquors. And so this is one point in which the Anglicans would not relinquish, except at sword point. They would not give up their privilege of bacon and beer. He said, no, we need to get back to what is important and begin to kind of affirm those things.
Well, Terry Linval, you know, here we are in the political season, a lot of people throwing around their ownership of God. Any particular satirist that might help us out at this season?
I think one person would be Giovanni Gorecchi. He created a little priest called Don Camillo, who was very pugilistic, and he would fight with anyone. But Giovanni Gorecchi said, essentially, the person who doesn't know how to laugh doesn't know how to rule. And this is the key test to look to see if a candidate can laugh with another person. It's like that wonderful parable in which a candidate dies unexpectedly and goes before St. Peter. He says, I want to get into heaven. And says, well, St. Peter says, we have a rule. You've got to go visit hell and heaven first. He says, okay. So he goes down to hell, and down in hell, he's there. And all of a sudden, he sees all of his friends. He sees everyone partying. Their Episcopal bishop serving one of the best wines. There's a golf course. Everyone's having a good time. So he goes up to heaven, and he visits there. And people are sitting around a table, and they're eating, and they're laughing, and they're conversing, and having a really nice time. And so he comes back to St. Peter and says, okay, I've decided I want to go to hell. And Peter says, okay, that's your choice. And he heads on his way to hell to meet with all of his friends. And then when he gets down there, all of a sudden, things stink and smell like sulfur. And it's heat, and everyone is picking up trash. And he goes to the devil. He says, what happened? He says, this wasn't what I saw. He says, we were campaigning then. Now you voted. So we must beware of the campaigns unless they are laughing somewhere.
Terry Linval, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Terry Linval, he's C.S. Lewis Chair of Communication and Christian Thought at Virginia Wesleyan College. For more on his films and books, including God Mocks, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. How does this sound for a gig? Twice a year, you meet in a European capital with representatives from various nations to choose the color of the year. One for spring and one for fall. The results are published by Pantone. That's the company that standardized color reproduction in the 20th century and is now the global authority on color for designers and decorators and fashion's faithful hordes. For the first time ever this year, Pantone has chosen two colors for 2016's color of the year, spring. Rose quartz, a kind of medium pink, and serenity, which is a little bit cooler sky blue. At the helm for this decision was Leatrice Iseman. She's executive director of the Pantone Color Institute and co-author of Pantone on Fashion, A Century of Color in Design. We spoke to her last year when the book was first published for our Good Gig series. And I asked Leatrice if she'd always been drawn to color.
Absolutely. I mean, those of us who are drawn to color know that, and you recognize that it started very early in your childhood, where every kid has enjoyment out of playing with crayons. But for me, it was more than that. It was like an addiction. I had to repaint my room every other year, repaint the furniture in the room. even adults would come to me and ask my opinion about what colors to use together. So it's you know, for anybody who's into color, they completely get it. They can't remember a time when they weren't deeply involved with color.
And you continue to be deeply involved with color, and I'm dying to know about this, this whole choosing of the color of the year. I mean, is there a conspiracy here? Do you get a secret message from Anna Wintour or Miuccia Prada or Karl Lagerfeld to meet in a cabal and decide what it's going to be?
No, it's not anything like that. I mean, I think there are some who like to believe that, you know, we all have this secret meeting together. But it doesn't work that way. We at Pantone really do our homework in deciding on the color of the year, in that we have to look at many aspects of color. Most importantly, the zeitgeist. You know, what is a feeling that's out there afoot with consumers, with the average person on the street? We have to travel the world, literally looking at influences from all over the world. We look at what movies are in the production line. Is there a color story that's involved with a particular film that's going to get a lot of attention? We look at the world of art, certainly. Is there a big collection that's going to be going around the world? Is it getting a lot of attention? What is the artist that's involved? We look at even sports events. Is the Olympics going to be held in a specific year? What is the host country? What are the team colors? We certainly look at the fashion world because that's hugely important. And at Pantone, we do have a leg up in that we ask the designers to send us illustrations in and of a given season well ahead of time. And then the symbolism of the color is hugely important. What does the color say? You know, what is the psychological message that it gives, and that is that appropriate for a particular time period?
I'd love to get to the names, because for one thing, when you're doing this historical survey back to the early 20th century, color was not always apparent in black and white photographs that were used in fashion magazine for much of the 20th century. So where do you find the material speaking of something as specific as color, especially when they're not named as we might name them?
If we look back through the ads, we found that there were catalogs. Even Vogue put out a wonderful fashion publication, not like the Vogue of today, but very elegant. And in the 20s, I found a yellow-green shade that just I could not believe that this very citrusy, very contemporary-looking color was even available to anybody in the 20s. So it's a learning experience for me, too, as I delve back through the historical aspect of fashion. And that's one of the most fun things about doing this kind of book.
I'm glad you mentioned that about not even knowing that people would wear this color at this time. Because in the introduction to the book, you write about the democratization of color that began in the mid-19th century. What was going on?
Well, it was technology, really, because we know, if we go back really a long time ago, purple was the color that was meant only for royalty. Well, the real reason why the royalty and the, you know, the people who had a lot of money wore purple and the common person didn't wear purple was all about the economics of purple. Purple was not available as a dye unless you had access, as they did in ancient Phoenicia, to hammer these tiny little mollusks open, get the juice, the extract of those little tiny snails, and accumulate that so that you could dye an entire garment. Well, you can imagine that's pretty labor-intensive. So as a result, only the wealthy could afford to pay for such a garment. Whereas, you know, coming up to the last century, even a little bit before that, purple dye was accidentally discovered in a lab where they saw that this color could be made, and it could be made for far less money. And so the average person could then afford to buy a purple dress. That's what I meant by democratization.
So you also write about what color has come to mean through the ages. Black, of course, the color of mourning for the Victorians. Red, the color of blood and fire and fertility and the life force traditionally. How does color work on us? I mean, it actually stimulates our brain.
No, there's no question of that. There's the psychological and the physiological effect of color. If you can imagine going back to the beginning of time, if ancient people saw, you know, bloodshed or the color of fire, they attached the feeling of danger. I mean, red was something that could not be ignored. It had to be looked at. Now, after centuries of being implanted with that idea, that concept, we know red enters our field of vision. We can't avoid looking at red. Our eye automatically will go to it. Now, it could be a warning signal. Again, it's a red stoplight. There's sexual excitement that comes into play here, too, the red lipsticks. So that there's a various applications of the color, even though if you go back to the beginning of time, it usually was some connection with color as it appeared in nature. Another example I can give you is sky blue. Why is it that any place in the world, if you show people a little Pantone swatch of sky blue, they will invariably say, oh, it's such a peaceful color. It's so serene. It is a dependable color. It's loyal. These are the kinds of words that we get back in color word association studies that we conduct.
That's why I'm told that politicians wear blue ties.
Exactly. Exactly. That is exactly the message that they want to give across. So, you know, we see that color can be manipulated. People will wear it for specific reasons to give certain messages because they know that most people will regard that color the same way.
Color also gives us a sense of time, like what I like to call that 1930s kitchen green, you know. and there's this bright marigold now associated with Hermes that kind of had its day in the 40s, we read in your book, brought back much later by Carolina Herrera.
Yes.
So how do these colors cycle back? What do you think is going on in our history that brings them back around?
Well, there's numerous reasons for that. But if a color hasn't been prominent for several years, if you do bring it back, and the best example I can give you is avocado green, anybody who was alive in the late 60s and 70s knows that it was used in every plush carpet, in every dishwasher, because that was the all-pervasive color at that time. And you had a different mindset in those days. You had people who really did slavishly follow what everybody else was doing.
I want to pick up something I dropped because you just reminded me of it again. The color names that you come up with at Pantone, you know, blue iris, lavender fog, rose wine, glacier gray, opal, hemlock. Wonderful, wonderful names. How do you do this all together in your secret cabal?
Well, there is kind of a secret cabal that does that. And we do it really because with Pantone, you know, we have over 2,000 names that already have colors. So it gets more and more challenging as we move forward. So you have to be considerate of certain elements. Like if you name a color that is just too timely at a specific time, you know, I can remember when we were doing some purples and somebody came up with Barney Purple. And I said, no. We don't know how long Barney is going to be popular. And if that show bites the dust, there goes Barney Purple. So we nixed Barney Purple.
Thank you.
At the same time, thank you for that. But at the same time, there are some beautiful, beautiful names. I mean, you only have to look at flowers and foliage and, you know, places around the earth and beautiful sights to look at that can give you all kinds of inspiration for color names.
So did you buy Mimosa in 2009 or Radiant Orchid?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have to. It's part of my uniform. If I'm going to go out and talk to people, which I do all the time, you know, I travel around the world doing presentations. You know, if I'm going to talk the talk, I have to walk the walk.
And that was my earlier conversation with Leatrice Eisman, Executive Director of the Pantone Color Institute. If you'd like to check out the 2016 Colors of the Year for spring for yourself and read why Leatrice and her team chose those two colors, you'll find a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today, and there is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. If you missed any of the show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2 here on NHPR.